It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at American history from a Native American perspective with a historian set on debunking some persistent myths.
First, with only 1.5 weeks before the midterm elections, Governor Scott Walker yesterday called on his supporters to counter what he calls the bastion of angry liberal voters in Madison by showing up at the polls on November 4th.
And we found out yesterday in the WPR St. Norbert survey that a majority of likely Mary Burke voters said their main reason for their vote was their opposition to Scott Walker and his policies.
And this got us wondering, what is motivating people to vote in this election? And we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Do you feel more motivated to vote this year than before? Why or why not? What is inspiring you to vote for incumbent Governor Walker or challenger Mary Burke, or that what's inspiring you to not make up your mind quite yet and give it another week and a half to mull it over? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We've got Joan on the line in Eau Claire to start us off. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'll certainly be casting my vote for Mary Burke. I can't fathom how any citizen who cares about Wisconsin, even in the smallest measure, would cast a vote for Walker. He has zero integrity. He's lied about so many things, is extremely disingenuous. The legislation that he's rammed through is anti-environment, anti-green energy, anti-women's rights, anti-public education, anti-worker. Mary actually advocates for preserving our environment. She advocates for women's rights. She's for public education. She's for people getting education. And she's for workers' rights. I find it insulting that Walker labels people who don't vote for him as angry, or the Madison voters as angry. I find that a bit insulting.
Well, Joan, anyway, do you led with what you don't like about Governor Walker. Do you feel more motivated by the negatives you perceive in him than by the positives you see in Mary Burke?
Well, I do see positives in Mary Burke. She appears to be genuine. But we've known Walker for 4 years, more than 4 years, really. And like I said, he's disingenuous. I don't feel that we can trust him. But what we do know about him is many, many negative things.
All right, Joan, thanks a lot for the call. We've got, full lines for the moment, but you can share your thoughts, your motivations on who you're going to vote for or what remains to make up your mind. 800-642-1234, talking about the race for governor here in Wisconsin. Lou in Cudahy joins us next. Lou, hi, you're on the air.
I think Mary Burke is manifestly unqualified. Apparently she hasn't worked in the last 7 years, and with the Doyle administration, he was about to terminate her when she quit, and the insiders are saying that she's just cannot connect and just is a kind of a basket case when it comes to leading for commerce.
Well, Lou, let me ask you the same question I asked the previous caller. Are you voting for the governor more because of your worries about Mary Burke or because of positives you perceive in the governor?
I'm voting for Governor Scott Walker because of his absolute record of success and what he's done to put us back on the right track and turn things around.
Lou, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Ann in Wauwatosa. Ann, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just want to say that for Governor Walker to malign the entire city of Madison and say that they're all liberals and they're all angry and that Democrats are motivated by anger and, I guess, stupidity, and Republicans are motivated by patriotism and, you know, just is so offensive. I have many friends, neighbors, and family members who are not the same political persuasion as myself, and I believe that they love their country and this state as much as I do. And that is what I find just incredible.
Ann, thanks a lot for the call. We are inviting your thoughts on why you are supporting the candidate you support for governor in a week and a half or so, or why you haven't made up your mind, what you're still looking for, based on the comments from Governor Walker. He's rallying his supporters, saying, hey, we've got to balance out angry liberal voters in Madison. We heard in the WPR St. Norbert survey, a lot of Mary Burke supporters, a majority, say their main reason for voting for her is opposition to the governor and or his policies. You can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also send us a quick email if you want, talk@WPR.org. Don joins us next in Manitowoc. Don, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm for Burke, and the reason I'm for Burke is that she's a uniter. Scott Walker has just been such a divisive person. He ran the first time, never clued the voters into the atom bombs he was about to drop. He is now saying that Mary Burke is a plagiarizer. Well, who's a plagiarizer? When you have the mining company author the bill that you're going to put in that's going to destroy the environment, and you put your name on it, and then you submit it as your work, I think that's a bigger deal of plagiarism than hiring somebody to put out a work for you, and you're defining what that work should be, and then you put your name on it. So I'm all for Mary Burke.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. Going next to Pat with us in Marshfield. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you today?
Good. What do you think?
I think Mary Burke all the way. I don't think we can trust Mr. Walker. He's done nothing but lie to us and hurt the people. My wife works for the school district up here, and he came through and he tore their insurance right out of their hands, and they had to install an insurance that just about broke half the district.
Pat,
and now they went back to the same one.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Fred up in Hayward. Fred, hi.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is because I think the people, if they go to the polls, should ask themselves, first of all, are we better off today than we were 4 years ago? That's the big question. Nobody gets a free lunch, and I think Walker's done that for us. Also, our education has not went downhill, and I talked to a state patrol guy. In fact, he stopped me and gave me a warning ticket. And he said the first 3 weeks after that thing, I was kind of mad. But then I went home and talked to my wife, and I realized that Walker wouldn't have had to do something. Eventually, through the negatives, we would have had to lay off part of the state employees because there'd be no money for them. Thank you.
Fred, thanks a lot for the call. And there are better ways to strike up political conversations, I think, than getting pulled over. Thanks, Fred. We'll go to Katie now in Eau Claire. Katie, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm just calling. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a conservative, but I am going to vote for Mary Burke. The main reason is I just have been so upset with what Scott Walker has done to our education system in this state. And I believe deeply that in order for a society to be successful, we have to have very strong public schools with equal access to all. And it's just been, I've never felt so strongly about a candidate based on that.
And you don't see yourself as somebody in the past who's voted typically Democrat, typically Republican?
To be honest, I probably vote more Democratic, but I really do try to look at the complete candidate. And, you know, I'm actually pretty all over the board. I'm pretty conservative with specific things and a little more liberal with certain things, but... I'm not one or the other.
Gotcha.
Strongly, so.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Katie. We heard from Angela on Facebook, who makes the case for voting, period, because she says it matters. I haven't missed a single election that I've been eligible to vote in since I turned 18. So, okay, it's not for either candidate, but for getting out and voting in general. Well, I think we'll leave it there for now. You can keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Thanks so much to everyone who called in this segment. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Political observers say there are three open state Senate districts to watch this fall. If Democrats win the three, they'll take control of the Senate. One of those is in the Republican stronghold of the 9th District. Patty Murray reports.
The 9th Senate District encompasses the cities of Manitowoc and Sheboygan, along with many small towns. Devin Lemieux wants to keep it in Republican hands. In 8 years, he's risen through the ranks of the Sheboygan County Board, where he says he's helped keep a lid on property taxes.
I'm pretty fiscally conservative.
If elected, he says he'll bring that approach to the Senate.
We're still one of the top 10 tax states in the nation. We need lower taxes, a more flatter tax system, also making sure that the government isn't making sure that regulation and red tape isn't slowing down business and putting up obstacles.
Lemieux owns the Lakeshore Weekly. It's a shopper-style newspaper that has a wide circulation in the Sheboygan area.
It gives me a chance to meet different business leaders in the community, talk to them about things that are going on.
It's that community connection that could help Lemieux win, according to UW Oshkosh political scientist Jim Simmons.
His father was in the assembly. He's run for office before. He's heads the county board there.
Of the three open seats, Simmons believes the 9th is the least likely to flip from Republican to Democrat. The only reason the seat is open is because incumbent Republican Joe Lieben gave it up to run for Congress. He narrowly lost the primary to Glenn Grothman. Simmons doubts Democrats had any chance of winning the district if Lieben chose to run again. So the state Democratic Party asked Martha Lanning to run. Simmons says any Democrat would have trouble winning the race because voters in the district supported Governor Scott Walker in 2010 and the 2012 recall. He says Lanning has other weaknesses. She's never held elected office, and some see her as an outsider.
She has a problem because, you know, she's moved around a lot in her career. You know, in Wisconsin, oftentimes, if your great-grandparents weren't born in Wisconsin, you're seen as a newcomer.
Lanning has lived in the town of Sheboygan for 8 years. She's worked on multi-million-dollar fundraising projects. She describes herself as a moderate Democrat and a fiscal conservative, thanks in part to her degree in accounting. If sent to Madison, she says her biggest concern will be the budget.
We actually spent $200 million more than we took in last year, so the year ending June 30th of 2014. And if we just laid out the budget as it is exactly, will be $550 million in the hole, even further in the hole, after this year.
Lanning says she doesn't want to raise taxes, take on more debt, or make cuts to things like education. But there is one tax bill she'd vote to repeal.
They passed a law just recently in their most recent budget that all manufacturers by the year 2016 will pay no state income tax. And I've talked to manufacturers who think that's just crazy. They don't mind paying some tax. They just don't want to be taxed to death.
Some parts of Wisconsin, like the Fox Valley, have seen demographic shifts making them more competitive. But people from Milwaukee are moving into the 9th District, effectively making it an exurb. Jim Simmons, the political scientist, says some of them are bringing their conservative ideals with them, possibly making it safer for Republicans. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
While nearly 3 million Native Americans currently live in the United States, and the country has more than 500 federally recognized indigenous nations, these communities remain among the poorest in the country.
Our next guest, a historian, says that Native Americans have been coerced into a colonial relationship with the United States and continue to suffer under it.
She says we need to start setting the record straight by examining and reframing the accepted American version of Native American history, which is peppered with myths she says need to be debunked.
With us now is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Professor Emerita of Ethnic Studies at California State University, Hayward. Her newest book is called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you say there's a big knowledge deficit about the real history of Native peoples. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, there's a distortion of Native American history, but my book deals more with the mythology of United States history that's based on an avoidance of dealing with certain aspects of that history, and the primary one being that the United States was born as a settler colonial country, already in the process as settlers under the British, and continuing under the Republic of eradicating the presence of Native Americans and taking their land. So this book is actually the Native American perspective on the history of the United States. So the main mythologies concerning Native Americans are justifications for a false history of the United States, what I call the origin myth of the United States.
Okay, well, let's start there, the origin myth of the United States. What do you see as being the foundational origin myth of the United States?
Okay, so the origin myth is that the United States was fought a valiant war of national liberation, anti-colonial, that they were being, the colonists were being oppressed by the colonial master, as if they were, you know, Kenya in the 20th century rebelling against Britain. And it's really just the opposite, because basically they were splitting the empire, making a new empire, the American Empire, and with, you know, the same methods as the British, the continuation. But the British had warred with France over a long period, and the French and Indian War, or the Seven-Year War, that ended in 1754, the British announced a proclamation that prohibited the British settlers from going over the mountain range, the Appalachians, Alleghenies. Many squatters were already there on native farmland. And so both the French and the British, in their settlement at the Treaty of Paris, agreed that the Ohio country, or all of the rest of the territory east of the Mississippi and the continent, would be Indian country, and would, although it would be under the British, part of it, and then, you know, the French in the north, that there would be no settler colonialism. The settlers, they could do trade, but not have settlements. So for the colonists who were already going there and seizing land directly from the native people, they were ordered to come back. And British soldiers actually were given orders to go out and, you know, make force people to come back to the 13 any of the 13 colonies.
Now, that's one myth that's out there that you're talking about. There's another that seems a little bit of a contradiction, which is one that you say is the perception of the continent being wild and uninhabited when the settlers first arrived here. So how do you square those two?
Well, that's, you know, part of the mythology. In the settlement, I mean, in the first settlement in Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay Colony, it was very clear that the, and in Virginia too, that there were thousands, you know, tens of thousands of Native people, their farmers and fishermen, and were resistant to the settlers coming in and trying to take their land and food supplies and making war on them. But there was the myth that started at that time was that this was a God-given right. Especially the Puritans had this worked out, that it was the New Jerusalem, that they were going into the wilderness, and that the savages were filled, were devils, and not only did they have the right to kill them, but an obligation to honor their religion to do so. So they posed these people who were just ordinary farmers and fishermen as devils, and then they could be killed. Once the once areas were cleared, Native people were removed by warfare, and then later on as an independent republic in the 1830s, all the Native people, there was ethnic cleansing east of the Mississippi, and they were driven out into Indian territory, which became Oklahoma. After that, the mythology developed that of very few scattered Native people that were not using the land, wasn't being used anyway. They were wasting it. I think it was Teddy Roosevelt said, who do these people think they are, you know, camping out for generations when the land could be used.
And we're going to hold it there and come back to this conversation. We're looking at the history right now of the United States from the perspective of its indigenous peoples, and we'd like to hear from you.
Are there myths about Native peoples in the United States, in the New World, that you'd like to see challenged or debunked? Do you have a question about what might be myth or reality? Are you from a Native American community? What are your thoughts on this topic? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue our conversation with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz after the news.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. We're exploring America's history from a Native American perspective with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, scholar and author, looking at some of the persistent myths about indigenous people in the United States.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think that most Americans understand enough about Native American history and understand what our guests would call the real story? What myths are you aware of that you might like to see corrected? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Roxanne, I want to skip around a little and talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln. Now, he is hailed by a hero, as by many people today. How do you see him when you look at him through the lens of Native American history?
Well, he was, you know, he was called a free soiler. It's the party that he formed. And his, for the planters in the South, large swaths of lands were, of course, taken by force away from these large nations of Native people who farmed and lived in towns. That was done, and they were removed. But in the North, there were still many Native villages and farmland, and in there were wars, particularly going on in Minnesota, to take Native land. Immigrants had been brought in, Scandinavian immigrants, German immigrants, and allowed to go there, but in fact there was no agreement with the Native people that they could be there. So they requested the army to come in. So this Lincoln's party was wanted to take land for his constituency were landless farmers who wanted land, so to make land available to them. So the free soil meant stolen free soil. So during the war itself, wars against Native people continued. The Navajo Nation people were rounded up. Kit Carson, the mercenary in New Mexico, was given an army commander position to do that job. They were force marched into a desert concentration camp where one half of them died of starvation and exposure in the very hot southern New Mexico desert. So that was on Lincoln's order and happened during that time, the most tragic event in Navajo history. And in Minnesota, the Minneconjou Dakota people were fighting for their lives to stay there, and they were deemed by the Lincoln administration to be, well, what we would call, well, terrorists now, but unlawful combatants of, and they were randomly kind of rounded up, whoever they could capture, whatever person, sometimes just a farmer walking down the road. And so there were around 300 of them rounded up, and they were sentenced to hanging, mass hanging. And Lincoln had to give the final order. This is, you know, in federal orders. So he ordered that fewer of them, only a representative amount, you know, a third of them be, or less, would be hung. So this was the largest mass execution in United States history to today, when these Dakotas, who were then by the army people just picked out at random, you know, without any particular reason. So it was really just killing, you know, terrorizing these Dakota farmers. So that they would leave, you know, they would get out of the territory. So Lincoln was simply continued the same kinds of methods, had the same kind of attitudes as previous presidents. The wars being made against the Apaches and the Navajos and the Dakotas. That went along, you know, that happened during the Civil War, hardly ever make it into the into history texts. There's even one occasion in New Mexico when the Confederates also, you know, were fighting for that territory, and they're fighting, the Confederates and the Union armies fighting each other in New Mexico, but there was an occasion where they both started fighting the Apaches on the same side, the Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers on the same side. So for Native Americans, there was little difference between those two forces.
Now, another thread that you talk about is the narrative that Native people died out, that they were dying out, which makes it sound as though there was no catalyst for this. Where does that idea come from?
Well, this is, you know, this is what has come to be called the terminal narrative, that with the recent, and it's been very recent, only with Native American documentation and insistence and going to the United Nations and getting documentation of genocide being committed against Native Americans by government policy and government orders. So now it's fairly accepted, not totally accepted, but it is a commonplace to hear of either ethnic cleansing or genocide that did take place by the United States. But in doing so, they add to this, and from the beginning, you know, also under the British, that it was a kind of passive genocide, that it was a disease, you know, a sort of natural, a natural spreading of disease unintentionally, and for Native people who had no immunity. So there are so many false assumptions and premises within that I try to break it down in the book, of that a pandemic like that, say the bubonic plague in medieval Europe that killed off half the population of Europe, it did not mean that those people did not continue. In fact, the genocide against the Jews did not mean those people did not continue as a people and still continue today. So genocide doesn't mean wiping every single person out. And the diseases certainly didn't do that. So they have... other things are, you know, are played down, like the unrelenting warfare by both irregular forces of militia settlers, like Andrew Jackson, the way he started with it, forming the Tennessee militia, and they just go out on their own and take land and kill civilians.
I'm gonna jump in here so we can get a caller in on this. Let's take Rick in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Good afternoon. So my ancestry settled Green Bay. We were Scottish ancestry, and there's a couple of comments I had. I played with and lived with the Oneida Nation, and so I, from a very early age in the 60s, heard the Native American viewpoint, which obviously shocked me as a little boy. I've always felt guilty that my DNA may have had a part in these terrible things done to these wonderful people. And I've got two questions. The first one is it true, and can you say who was more cooperative and respectful? Because I had heard that the Scottish, my ancestors, were very respectful of Native Americans versus the British. That's my first question. Is that a myth, or were we all just as bad? And the second thing is, you know, repeat the book a couple times so I remember. And what can I do now as a generational person to help the Native Americans have a better life and to help them be more valued?
Okay, thank you for your call, Rick. And the book is called An Indigenous People's History of the United States. And we're talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And Roxanne, what would you like to say to Rick?
Very good questions, Rick. Thank you. It's a mixed. My father's family is also from Scots background, but Scots Irish. So there were two categories of Scottish people, the Scottish settlers in Northern Ireland who had become a sort of perennial settlers. By then they had been allowed to go over and colonize indigenous Irish land in those brutal wars. And many of those same settlers moved on to the colonies, and they were pretty brutal. Scottish Highlander immigrants were a number of cases of very close relations with the native people. There was a close affinity. There were some cases of Scottish Highlanders forming militias in the early South, but I think there was an affinity on both sides. There was also intermarriage. For instance, the president of the Cherokee Nation, when the Cherokee Nation was forcibly removed from the South, John Ross himself was was Scottish, who married into the Cherokee Nation, and he's one of a Highlander from a Highlander background, and is still one of the great heroes of the Cherokee people. So you definitely are onto something there.
In our last minute, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Roxanne. We've got about a minute left. Would you like to speak to Rick's last question? He'd like to make personal reparations.
Yes. What can be done? I say, look into the treaties and agreements that Native people are demanding be validated. Also, the doctrine of discovery. I have a whole chapter in the book on this. This is the colonialist law that still keeps Native people in a colonial condition, and it's based on canon law from the 15th century, but it's inscribed in U.S. constitutional law from the 1830s. So look into those matters, but also the sacred lands that Native people are trying to get returned that were taken outside of treaties, and many of these are national parks or state parks like the Black Hills of the Lakota Sioux people in South Dakota, the Malpai in New Mexico, the San Francisco Peaks in Arizona, Mount Taylor in and not only are these parks, but they're also being mined for uranium and other, they're being abused, and these are sacred lands for Native people.
And we leave it there. Roxanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Professor Emerita of Ethnic Studies at California State University, Hayward. Her new book is An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our state news roundup. Today we'll be talking about the latest results in the WPR St. Norbert survey and get a preview of tonight's Attorney General candidate debate.
Noah Ofshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time. Hey, Noah.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon, and as always, happy Friday.
Definitely happy Friday to you as well. So, some new results in from the latest WPR St. Norbert College poll. What's the headline there?
The headline is further evidence this week that the governor's race is very, very close. And as Rob just said, the latest WPR St. Norbert College poll found the race to be basically a dead heat, and that's something we've seen here in recent weeks. Walker was up 1%, but that lead is well within the margin of error. So at this point, too close to call.
And what about that mythical group, the Undecideds? What do we know about
yes,
them?
Yes, I've heard of them.
Do they exist?
I've heard of such a group. And in fact, they do, according to this poll. And if we were to attach a number to it, it would be 6%. Apparently, the poll found that 6% remain undecided about who they're going to vote for governor. And, you know, with the race so close, you know, that means there's some wiggle room for both campaigns to get some of those folks. They could make a difference.
And what else could make a difference?
Well, turnout. Turnout among the base in particular. That will be very important for both candidates. In Mary Burke's case, her base, we're talking about Milwaukee. Make no mistake, the race hinges, at least in part, I would argue, on how many people show up to vote in Milwaukee. And if you're looking for evidence, I point to the people who have been coming to visit in Milwaukee trying to get out the vote for Mary Burke. And that list includes Michelle Obama. She's been to Wisconsin twice. Former President Bill Clinton in town today in Milwaukee, again, trying to get the vote out. And next week, President Barack Obama will be in Milwaukee trying to get the vote out for Mary Burke. So, again, turnout in Milwaukee being very important, either, you know, for Mary Burke, from Mary Burke's perspective, hopefully it'll be high. From the governor's perspective, hopefully it'll be low.
Now, the poll also got at something else, and that is what's driving voters in their choices. What did it find?
Right. So this particular poll is kind of unique in the sense that it asks open-ended questions, and then the answers are grouped together by theme. And so respondents who said they were voting for a certain candidate were asked why they were voting for that person. For Burke supporters, 61% said they were voting for her because they didn't like Governor Walker.
Okay, and so what did people say about Governor Walker who are going to vote for him?
Well, it's the opposite. It was among the governor's supporters, more than 60% said they backed him because they like him or his policies. So the takeaway here, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to vote for Burke, but not because of who she is, but rather who she isn't. And she's not the governor. So a very interesting, I think, in my mind, at least, a very interesting look into why people might be voting for Mary Burke in the coming weeks.
And moving on to another state story, some interesting demographics, an interesting demographic story out of Wisconsin this week. It turns out that birth rates are down in Wisconsin. This has been going on for a little while, it seems like. What's the story here?
Yeah, okay. So I find this to be interesting. I don't know. I'm kind of a demographics geek. So I find this kind of information to be interesting. And also, by the way, has impact across the state. 2013 was the sixth year in a row that the birth rate here in the state has declined. There were around 66,500 births last year, and that's a little bit more than 600 or so less than 2012.
So let's look at that in perspective. I'm sure you've crunched the numbers, Noah, being a demographics geek. So how does that compare historically?
Well, this number, 2013, last year's number is the lowest it's been since 1997.
Wow. So any idea what's behind these numbers?
You talk to the experts, they'll say there are several factors. And of course, it is a sort of a complicated picture. But among the things on the list, experts point to, women are delaying childbirth. For a variety of reasons, including the weak economy and the employment situation. Teen pregnancy is also down. Experts say teen pregnancy prevention strategies are working and that's having an impact on birth rates.
Now, if this continues, there are obviously big implications here. What's the outlook?
Well, at least one of the experts that we talked to told WPR that they expect birth rates to rise a bit once the economy improves. You know, when that'll be and what the economy will look like, you know, it's unclear. But, you know, if you look at the demographics over time, if you look at the projections, it's clear that Wisconsin as a state, and as well as many other states across the country, are getting older. And, you know, that will have a profound impact on education, healthcare, the job market, economic development. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's I think, one of the forces that will be driving this state in the coming decades, which is the fact that as a state, we're getting older.
Yeah, we did a Central Times story on this saying that this is an overall trend and that women may just be postponing childbirth forever. So I guess this is one we have to watch and see how it affects Wisconsin.
Yeah, and it will affect the state in many ways.
All right. Well, we've got a preview next of the attorney general debate tonight. What's going on tonight?
So, yeah, Brad Schimmel and Susan Happ are meeting for a debate tonight. It'll air live on WPR and Wisconsin Public Television at 7 o'clock tonight. And I find it to be a very interesting time to be debating, frankly, because, again, this race, like the governor's race, is really close.
And again, harking back to the WPR St. Norbert College survey, what are the numbers there?
Yeah, they found Republican Brad Schimmel leading Democrat Susan Happ 41% to 40%. So again, that's well within the margin of error. So again, basically a dead heat. The key difference in the race, though, is the number of people who are undecided. And, you know, we were talking about what that number being
6%.
6% for the governors. Well, for the attorney general, it's a whopping 21% say they are unsure.
That's a lot of people, a lot more people. So what's the difference?
A lot of people. I think it's due at least in part to the fact that there aren't a lot of people out there who know enough about the candidates to have an opinion one way or the other. They just don't have the name recognition that, you know, the candidates obviously for governor do. And I think that's reflected in the polling numbers.
So I suppose tonight this is the opportunity to get them out there once again and hopefully for either candidate get some of those undecideds off the fence.
Yeah, I think it'll be, again, another opportunity to talk about the issues and the differences that they have. You know, and if you look at some of those issues, a lot of attention, and it may come up tonight, a lot of the attention has been paid to, you know, the individual cases that they've been involved with as prosecutors. But there are some bigger policy type issues. Schimmel has said he would, you know, defend state laws regardless of whether he agrees with them or not. Happ has said it would depend on the law.
And what about other things, narratives that have emerged during this particular race?
The other theme that has come up, and I think will possibly come up again tonight, is the level of prosecutorial experience each candidate has. Schimmel is quick to point out that he has over 20 years of experience to Happ's 6. Happ is quick to point out that her years in private practice give her a unique set of skills as well.
Okay, well, we're going to leave that to the candidates tonight. Watch it and see what emerges from that one. And speaking of watching it, seeing what emerges, there is, I hear, a Packers game this Sunday.
Yeah, a little game between the Packers and the Saints. Very excited for that game. We'll see what happens. Two powerhouse quarterbacks. Although I will say the Packers they have a better streak, better record this year. So hopefully the Packers will have some momentum going into the game. They are playing in New Orleans, so that may impact the game as well.
Gotcha. Well, Noah, thanks a lot for stopping by.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, our news guy, WPR's assistant news director.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.